Okay, brethren, last week we began looking at the life of Joseph in the book of Genesis. We looked at the life of King David some weeks ago, and we've turned now to look at another important and quite famous personality in the Bible, which is Joseph. So let's recap very briefly, hopefully, what we covered last week, which is that, you know, Jacob, or Israel as he was also known, had four wives and 12 sons. And as you'd expect, there were some family difficulties. It seems that Jacob favored his son Joseph much more than any other, and made that rather plain. And of course, that caused additional problems. It's not really wise, in a sense, to show favoritism to, you know, one child in a family. It doesn't do much for the other children. Didn't do much for Jacob's family. Then, of course, Jacob had two dreams, and he mentioned those to his brothers, and they didn't like him anymore. And, in fact, we found out that Jacob's brothers, probably not Benjamin, his own younger brother, but the rest of them, Simeon and Reuben and Judah and so on, hated him. So even in a Bible family, you get hate, and they hate him. In fact, so strong was the hatred that at one occasion, as we saw, they actually planned to kill him. So here's a bunch of brothers, literally, this wasn't just a jokey idea, they were literally planning to kill their, at this point, 17-year-old brother. Reuben intervened, Judah had a better idea. What prophet says the first Jew in killing him? Let's sell him. So they sold him off to a passing caravan of Ishmaelites, and off went 17-year-old Joseph to Egypt, where he was purchased as effectively, I guess, a slave by Potiphar. Mr. Potiphar was the sort of head of state security, quite an important person in that sense. And so, you know, Joseph ended up in probably an okay location. But then, of course, after a little while, he was accused of rape by Potiphar's wife, and he ended up in prison, sort of political prison. Other enemies of the king were put there. And between the ages of 17 and 30, he was either serving Potiphar or he was in prison. We said last week that whilst Potiphar's wife rather threw herself at him and tried to seduce him, Joseph was an outstanding young man in many, many ways, whereas King David, we saw, succumbed to the lure of Bathsheba, who was bathing herself, even though this Potiphar's wife came apparently again and again and again. You know, Joseph resisted. But despite being a good guy and doing all the right things, he's first in slavery and then next he's in prison. And yet we also saw, hopefully, that he maintained a great attitude throughout all this period. He just trusted God and trusted God and trusted God. He had a positive approach. He worked hard. Potiphar, first of all, recognized the favor of God's with this young man. He made him head over all his household. Then even in prison, the guard thought, well, this guy really is switched on. He's super wise and a great attitude. So he made him essentially head of the prison. So fantastic, really, in some ways, that Joseph just kept on going with his head up and his heart and hope in the right place. Then, of course, we saw that Pharaoh had a couple of strange dreams of these cows and heads of grain. Couldn't figure out what on earth it meant. And so Joseph was summoned from prison. And within a few hours, Joseph is prime minister of the Egyptian empire. Number two man in the entire empire, only the pharaoh above him, which is pretty dramatic. And then as we got to the end of last week, we saw that 7 years of plenty had elapsed in the land in which they'd stored up much, much surplus. But now, of course, unfortunately, 7 years of great famine are going to strike not only Egypt, but actually the entire nations around Egypt. And that brings Joseph's brothers finally down to Egypt hunting for some food. So they've come to purchase grain from Egypt, and of course, who do they bump into? Well, Joseph, who recognizes them but they don't recognise him. I mean, he was a 17-year-old kid when they last saw him, and now he's nearly 40 years old. He looked very different, no doubt, dressed entirely differently. And after all, the man they're speaking to is the head man, the boss man of the Egyptian Empire. Wouldn't be their brother. That would never cross their mind. And that's where we got to pretty much last week. But before we pick up the story, there were some sort of lessons we tried to extract last week, looking at these people like King David or Saul or Joseph now. There are lessons that you and I can learn. Probably quite a few. The ones I've picked out, three I've picked out. One would be that, you know, sometimes in life we do hit difficult periods. We do go through much tribulation to enter into the kingdom of God. And Joseph certainly went through significant amounts of difficulty and dismay and disappointment. And even though he did good, I mean, he was just outstanding from almost day one. Yet he ended up in slavery and then in prison, even though he was resisting the temptation of Potiphar's wife and so on. And one lesson is that you and I sometimes will suffer for doing good. We will suffer wrongly for actually being good. It does happen. Now let's look at 1 Peter 2, verses 18 to 23. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verses 18 to 23. You know, sometimes we think because we're being good and going God's way that everything is plain sailing and the sun will shine and the breeze will blow and people will just fall down and love us. And it'd be nice if that were the case, of course. And at times, hopefully that would be the case, but not always. And Joseph's a very good example of a young man doing what is right by God, of very high moral standards, working his socks off for Potiphar and in prison. And yet seemingly it's just not working. And here we are, verse 18, as servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer for it, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. So you're doing good, like Joseph was, and yet, you know, you're badly treated. And it says here, if you take it patiently, doesn't mean necessarily start smiling and kicking, sort of snarling, sorry, and kicking and biting and being moody and throwing a pity party. It says you take it patiently for conscience sake. You know you've done the right thing. You know God's with you in it. Others, for whatever reasons, are treating you harshly, and you just take it patiently. And then even Jesus had to have the same experience, verse 21, for to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. So Jesus actually set as an example of one who did good. You know, he cleansed lepers, you know, fed thousands, gave sight to the blind, did all great things, and yet he was accused of being a glutton, a wine bibber, and of course, ultimately, you know, we know how that ended. So that's an example. So you and I shouldn't be desperately surprised if sometimes we suffer for doing good, but we shouldn't snarl, bite, and do things that are very carnal. That's not quite what the instruction is. Okay, another example that we can pick up from Joseph is really that there are times in life when you and I need to be patient, right? Lord, give me patience and give it to me right now. Well, of course, it doesn't work that way, but sometimes it takes time. Seed time and harvest. You know, seed time and harvest. There is a time between the seed being sown and the harvest being reaped. You sow and you reap, and sometimes there's quite a long gap there, but you've got to keep on being patient. Look at Matthew 24:13. You might quote that one, I suppose, off by heart. Matthew 24:13. the so-called Olivet prophecy. But this one verse, it's not really taken out of context because you can apply it in different scenarios. This scenario is the rather difficult period at the end of the age when lots of problems and difficulties and suffering are going on. But it says here in verse 13, he who endures to the end shall be saved. He who endures halfway, he who endures 90% of the way, he endures 99% of the way. Well, no. He who endures to the end shall be saved. Think of Joseph's life. Perhaps he managed to, you know, recover from being sold to Egypt. Perhaps he managed to get over being a slave in Potiphar's household. Perhaps, but then when he got sort of, you know, thrown into prison for resisting Potiphar's wife's seductions, did he give up then? Say, that's it. You know, I've tried to go God's way and I've kept my spirits up, but this is the last. It's too much now. Well, he didn't, did he? And when the, you know, the butler forgot about Joseph and didn't say, oh, there's a guy in prison that really helped me, I want to tell you about him, he was forgotten there. So there are many opportunities for Joseph to give up before enduring to the end. But he didn't. He kept on going. And obviously that's good advice for you and me. Or look at Hebrews 6, verses 9 to 12. Hebrews chapter 6. And beginning in verse 9. But beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. Yes, things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this manner. For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and indeed do minister. You know, God watches, God sees, God's aware, God's got a good memory. Verse 11, and we desire that each of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end, that you do not become sluggish or lazy, but imitate those who through faith and patience inherit their promises. It requires, you know, faith and patience. I think we used to refer to those some years back in messages as the power twins. You need faith, but faith that lasts for 30 minutes or a day and a half probably isn't going to work. But faith that continues and continues and continues patiently and continues patiently unto the end delivers. And as it says here, it's through faith and patience. He that shall endure unto the end shall be saved. And that's a fairly good lesson looking at the life of Joseph. Joseph kept on going. He clearly trusted God. He wasn't bitter and twisted and vengeful. He just kept on going and kept on going and kept his spirits up. And he had a great attitude that was recognized by all those around him. I'm not sure we would necessarily have come through with shining colors like Joseph, but it's a good example. And I guess the third lesson we could learn, a practical lesson we could learn, which might become clearer today as we go through the rest of the story, is we should not hold grudges against people. Of course, it's very carnal to hold grudges and, you know, get my own back in them, but it's not good for us. If we look at Romans 12, 17 to 21, Romans chapter 12, the thing with, you know, Joseph, as we'll see today as we pick up the story, he's now meeting his brothers again after 20 plus years since he last saw them. These are the guys that hated him. These are the guys that plotted to kill him and might well have done so if things hadn't turned out a wee bit differently. And these are the guys that then sold him to, you know, passing caravan of travelers and merchants. And poor old Joseph, he's only 17, ends up in slavery and then in prison, all because of these scumbag brothers of mine. So what's he going to do? Be bitter and twisted and hate them? Seek revenge? Well, I mean, we all know Joseph by now. That's not the man Joseph, but picking up what the scriptures are saying. Of course, Joseph didn't have access to the verses that you and I do. He seemed to know it for other reasons. But picking up in verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. Well, not even my brothers who sold me into slavery. Surely that would be merited. No, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Now, of course, if they choose not to live peaceably, you can't do a great deal about, you know, their attitude and their choices. But in terms of, you know, your part, now you and I can control our part. And it looks like Joseph just had this down to a T. Beloved, verse 19, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. So you and I don't need to sweat it, so to speak, because if there's any vengeance necessary, then God, who knows the whole story and who knows the heart, will take the relevant action in due time. We can get on with life. We don't have to take vengeance. We don't know the whole story. We're not necessarily going to be entirely fair and entirely objective, but God will be. So leave it to God. That's Paul's advice. Verse 20, therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, I said Joseph didn't have access to this, but he did the right things, irrespective. Look at Matthew 18, 21 to 22. So the advice is don't hold grudges, because Joseph didn't. Another great example to us. Matthew 18, 21 and 22. I think you remember this one. It's fairly well known. Then Peter came to Jesus and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Would that be up to, let's say, seven times? Because, I mean, Peter knows a thing or two. And he's thinking, no, I'm fairly impressed, my Lord, that I'd be willing, you know, to go up to seven times. And Jesus said to him, well, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. I said, what? So I think Peter probably a bit aghast, but forgive. Forgive your brother. Have an attitude of forgiveness. Don't have an attitude of holding grudges, because grudges actually probably have got no effect on the person against whom you're holding a grudge. But for you and I, to hold grudges affects us. You might be today holding a grudge against some family member or some church member, or some co-worker somewhere. And even to this day, when you think of them, you know, the bile might rise in your throat, you know, your hands and fists clench. They would know nothing about it. They could probably care less. But for you, it will affect your health. It will affect your peace of mind. It will affect you spiritually. So, you know, holding a grudge affects us, not the other person. I think I mentioned before the guy in church some years back who, the very first night of the Feast of Tabernacles, the get-together service, he walked into the hall, and I saw him there at the time. And then the next day, I thought, where's so-and-so gone to? And I didn't see him the rest of the feast. Until I think it was actually after the last great day. And then he turned up on the last great day. I said, oh, hi, so-and-so. I haven't seen you for a while. It wasn't that big a sort of feast. I think there's about 700 or 800 people. So you'd probably expect to at least see people throughout the sort of the 7 or 8 days. What had happened was on the get-together service, he'd spotted somebody he'd had an argument with in the church, I think about 10 years earlier. Mm-hmm. 10 years earlier. And he just thought, oh, I can't stay here. It's so-and-so. He did this to me. And he went off and spent the entire feast traveling around Britain by train rather than being at the feast and attending services, because he couldn't stand to be in the same room, even with, you know, 700 or 800, where this other guy was. Tragedy to stupidity. So do not hold a grudge. Look at Proverbs 10. And verse 12, Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12. Brief and to the point, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. So there's Joseph, there's these, ten of his brothers at this stage who sold him into slavery and were plotting to kill him and used to hate him and who knows what sort of rough life they'd given him up to that point. Now what does he do? Resort to carnal bitterness and twisted and hating? Or does he allow love to cover all sins? Well, the wise action, which is what Joseph took, but really the question is not so much what Joseph did in his day. You know, he's run his course, he's asleep now, waiting the resurrection. The question about the verse in front of us is, you and me. Hatred stirs up strife. But if we love, then we'll cover sins. Look finally at Proverbs 19 and 11. Proverbs 19 and 11. And here it says, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and it is to his glory to overlook a transgression. Now you got to say that surely describes Joseph. The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and it's to his glory to overlook a transgression. But then the lesson really is, what about you and me? You know, do we insist on having our pound of flesh in every situation? No. Nobody's going to spite me. If they build buckets, I'll build baths. You know, out to kill somebody that, you know. Anyway, there's some good lessons there from Joseph. But let's move on. So we turn to Genesis and pick up the story just about where we left off, which I think was Genesis 42. But let's pick up in verse 14. So back to Genesis. Genesis 42. And I think we had read this, but we'll just go over this part again. This is Genesis 42 and verse 14 through 22. And this is where the brothers are standing in front of Joseph. He knows who they are, but not vice versa. And we pick him now in verse 14. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. Well, this is the manner you'll be tested by. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. Now, he knows they're not spies, of course, it's his brothers. But there's, it's not a game exactly, but you know, these brothers were quite a bad bunch, as we know from last week. And I think there's some lessons which they're going to have to learn somewhat the hard way to bring them to a better place in their lives. And whether Joseph absolutely knows that right now, or whether he's being led by the Spirit of God, who knows exactly. Verse 17. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. Then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you, the rest of you, go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother. Now, remember, this is something like 20 years has elapsed. You know, Joseph was 17. He was promoted to prime minister at the age of 30. That's 13 years. Then there's 7 years of plenty. So that's 20-odd years. Now you're about a year or something into the famine period. So about 20, 21 years has elapsed. And in this difficulty here, when they're told that you're spies, going to keep one of you until you go and bring back this other brother you've mentioned, their first thoughts are, it's because of what we did. You know, they said to one another, we are guilty. We are truly guilty concerning our brother. For we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore this distress has come upon us, because we did a great sin 2 decades ago. That's why we're in this trouble right now. Obviously, it played in their minds, because it's the first thing they think of. And they're all agreed. We're in a big hole because we sinned all those decades ago against our younger brother. And then Reuben answered and said, yes, it is your fault. You know, did I not speak to you saying, do not sin against the boy, and you wouldn't listen? It's all your fault. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he had been speaking, you know, through an interpreter, because they think he's an Egyptian. But he understands what they're saying, and, you know, this is probably the start of the process, in a sense, where their sins of the past, they're starting to dwell up, starting to make them really think, and start to, you know, be a bit more introspective and wondering about, you know, cause and effect. And, of course, you know, sins can find you out, can they not? If you hold your place there, turn to Numbers 32, 16 to 23, Numbers 32, Numbers 32. Verses 16 to 23. The background to this part is it's in the about to cross over the Jordan, Israel, after the Exodus, only properly cross over at this time, and they're going to go in and, you know, battle to take the land and so on. But a couple of the tribes have found some other land they'd like to stop in without going over the Jordan. It's attractive land, it's good pasture land, they want to stay there and build their homes up and ranches there. And Moses isn't very impressed by this idea that you're not going to go across and fight with the rest of the nation. You're going to stay back here, are you? And just get comfortable, and the rest of the nation is going to go over and fight, you know, all the other tribes over there. And they said to him, verse 16, they came near to Moses and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves, the men basically, will be armed, ready to go before the children of Israel until we have brought them to their place. And our little ones will dwell in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until every one of the children of Israel has received his inheritance. So they're saying, look, Moses, we want to stay here. We like the land. We're gonna do that. But honestly, we promise we will, as men, as fighting guys, we will go with, not Moses, because he was not going to make that journey, but we will go across the Jordan and we will fight, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the other tribes until they've got all of their territory, and then we'll return here. But we want to be here. Verse 19. For we will not inherit with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on this eastern side of the Jordan. Then Moses said to them, okay, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before the Lord for the war, and all your armed men cross over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then afterward you may return and be blameless before the Lord and before Israel. And this land, right here, shall be your possession before the Lord. But if you do not so, then take note, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. And we all know that phrase, don't we? Your sin will find you out. And if there's a bunch of guys whose sin has found them out, it's the 10 brothers who are just saying, oh no, it's because of what we did to our little brother. And Reuben says, it is, and I told you not to do it, it's a great sin. And our sin, boys, has finally found us out. And of course, there are consequences to sin. We cover that in David's life. You know, David was forgiven by God for his adultery and his murder of Uriah. But were there consequences? Yeah, there sure were. And in this particular case, of course, the brothers had concealed it. They had killed a kid or something, put the blood on Joseph's coat of many colors, take it back and said to their dad, hey, isn't that your son's sort of coat with all that blood all over it? So they, you know, deceived, concealed, plotted murder, sold him for money. And now, yep, their sin has found them out. Let's drop down back to chapter 42 and verses 29 to 38. So at this point, Simeon, one brother, has been kept in prison. The other, I guess that's nine, have been sent back with lots of grain back to Jacob. Verse 29, then they went to Jacob their father in the land of Canaan and told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man who is lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, we are honest men. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. But one is no more, and the youngest is with our father this day in the land of Canaan. Then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, by this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine of your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me so that I shall know that you are not spies but that you are honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you and you may trade in the land. That's what they told, you know, Jacob, broadly what took place. Verse 35, then it happened as they emptied their sacks. Surprisingly, each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. I wouldn't be surprised if Jacob thought, knowing his sons, that they've been guilty of dishonesty here. Probably been stealing, guys, because they knew they hadn't. And they're just thinking, oh, no, you know, God is against us. And they know why, because of the great sin that has now found them out. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. And then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you. Because that's a stupid offer, you know. Kill my two sons, you know. Kill your two grandchildren, Jacob. It's like, well, so I don't, Jacob just ignores him. He said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone. I guess of that particular part of the family, that's obviously Rachel, was the mother of Benjamin and Joseph. And in that sense, Benjamin, they think, is the only living sort of son of that part of the family. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, you would bring down my grey hair with sorrow to the grave. Chapter 43. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, go back, buy us little food. Well, this is not going to happen, is it? Not without some changes. One assumes that they may have thought the famine might have, you know, sort of eased after a season. Perhaps the rains would appear and things would be normal, but of course they don't know. What Joseph knows and the Pharaoh knows that actually the famine's got some years yet to run. So now they've run out of food. And Jacob says, well, go and get some more. And it does seem that Jacob isn't really in some ways a great, great leader. There's quite a few issues that looks with him. But Judah, you thought maybe Reuben ought to have spoken up because he was the eldest, but he seems to have been fairly hopeless. Reuben, they think, is the ancestor of the French. I'm making no further comments. Bonjour, monsieur. But Judah spoke to him, saying, hang on, the man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. And Israel said, well, why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you still had another brother? You know, but they said, well, hang on. The man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our kindred, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? And we told him according to these words. How could we possibly have known that he would say, well, bring your brother down? Then Judah said to, so Judah seems to be stepping up finally to the mark. This is the guy that, you know, actually sold his brother. It was his idea to flog him off. So Judah perhaps finally starting to, you know, become a bit more of a man, says, send the lad with me and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we could have returned the second time. Could have been there back by now if we hadn't argued and debated all this stuff. So Judah is taking, well, he's showing the leadership here. And the father said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man, a little balm, a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. So obviously some food, but not stuff perhaps you could actually, you know, live off day to day. So you can take that as a gift. I don't think that would have necessarily been a great gift to present to Joseph. Not in the sense it wasn't perhaps, you know, worth some money, but the caravan of merchants who carted poor old young Joseph off to Egypt was carrying, strange enough, balm, spices and myrrh. So if anything that might bring back memories of the time that you were carted off in slavery would be a present of balm, spices and myrrh. Wouldn't be the best selection to put before the man who runs the country, but that's because they didn't really realize that. Verse 12, take double money in your hand. Take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight rather than you guys stealing it. Yeah. Take your brother also and arise, go back to the man. And may God Almighty give you mercy before the man that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. But fatalistic on Jacob's part. So the men took the present and Benjamin. They took double money in their hand and arose and went down to Egypt. And they stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my home and slaughter an animal and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. Then the man did as Joseph ordered, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid, the brothers were afraid, because they were brought unto Joseph's house. And they said, it's because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may seek an occasion against us and fall upon us and take us as slaves with our donkeys. So they're not looking forward to this meal, really, are they? Famine in the land, they made a long journey, and they're being invited to the home of the head honcho, and they're panicking because he's after us. He's out for us. He's out to get us. When they drew near the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house and said, oh, sir. So even to the steward, you better be polite around here. We indeed came down the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came to the encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we have brought it back in our hand, and we have brought down other money in our hands to buy food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks. But the steward said, peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. Of course he did. Didn't keep it, but he had it. Then he brought Simeon out to them. That was, I guess, a happy period. I don't know how long the gap's been since Simeon was taken away, but quite a number of months, I'm sure. And so, Simeon, how are you? You looking okay? Good? Yep. So the man brought the men into Joseph's house, gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their donkeys feed. Then they made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon. The balm, spices, and myrrh. I'm sure Joseph looked forward to the memories being brought back freshly to his mind. For they heard that he would eat bread there. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed down before him to the earth. And of course, remember the dreams, that these sheaves would bow down to Joseph's sheaf, and they said, what do you think, you little, you know, that we're going to bow down to you? Well, here they are. It's not the first time. They're bowing down to the earth. Then he asked them about their well-being and said, is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive? Because obviously, you know, he's well into his hundreds at this stage. And so Joseph wants to sort of bring out, so quietly, politely, is my dad, is he still okay? And they answered, your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive, And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. And probably Joseph thought, I had a dream about this once, you know. Then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, so it's obviously his 100% brother, and said, is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Now his heart yearned for his brother, so Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went to his chamber, I guess his bedroom, and wept there, because he's actually quite soft in that sense. He's going through a bit of a sort of theatrical act here to try, probably with God's prompting, to sort of bring these guys a bit further down. I think they're moving the right way, but they've got a history behind them. So he washed his face, verse 31, and came out, and he restrained himself and said, serve the bread. So they set him a place by himself, and then by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that's an abomination to the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another. So, you know, Reuben at the head of the table, and then Simeon, and then all the way down the line to Benjamin. And they all looked at each other just thinking, hold on, this is order of our birth. And how can this be? Because, I mean, the odds of that, I've read somewhere about 1 in 40 million. It's not going to happen. If you take, you know, 11 guys and just line them up, it's not going to happen that you get them ordered, next oldest, all the way down to the youngest. But, of course, these are Joseph's brothers, and he knows pretty well who's whom. And they're looking around thinking, what on earth is going on here? This is something, you know, I guess they're... they're getting goosebumps. Something's happening here, and we're really, oh, dear me. Then he took servings to them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was five times as much as any of theirs, and so they drank and were merry with him. Well, party time. Fantastic. He's not going to kill us. In fact, we're being well fed, and, ooh, great. So far, you know, it would seem, you know, so good. dropping down to chapter 44. He commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry. Put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also, put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest. That's going to be Benjamin's sack. And also his grain money. So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. And when they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to his steward, get up. Follow the men. When you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is this not the one from which my Lord drinks, and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing. This is, of course, this silver cup. So he overtook them, and he spoke to them these same words. And they said to him, why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servants should do such a thing. Look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan the money we found in the mouth of the sacks for the first time. How could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Look, we're honest. We brought money back. We're not taking things. With whomever of your servants that is found, let him die. And we also will be my Lord's slaves. And he said, oh, okay. Now also let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and you shall be blameless. Then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. So he searched, and he began with the eldest, and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack, which, of course, is where Joseph said to put it. Oh, great surprise there, is there? But and they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city, because this is not looking good. Remember, Jacob was fearful that if you take Benjamin away, I'll never see him again. I'm bereaved of Joseph, and now Benjamin and Simeon's gone as well. Oh, what's happening to my family? Now, the question here, I guess, in a sense, and it might be what Joseph's doing, is, well, they abandoned young Joseph 20-odd years before for money because he got up their noses. Now, here's Benjamin going to be taken back to Egypt, allegedly as a slave, they think. Will they abandon him as they abandoned his brother Joseph? Or have these guys, you know, learned anything in the intervening years? Are their hearts somewhat softer now than they used to be. A bit like a nice little test to find out just what these guys will now do. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. This dream's coming true right, quite frequently. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" I doubt if he actually did that, but that's what he's saying to them. And Judah said, because that's, I guess, how he's trying to pretend that he knew they'd done some, you know, dishonest practice here. And Judah said, so it's Judah that answers rather than Reuben. So Judah appears now to be perhaps the leading brother in many ways. "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? We're speechless. There's nothing at all that we can say here. We're out of words. God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, your sin shall find you out." And they don't know that he knows, if that makes sense, what they're on about. But they know what they're on about. And they know that what they did all those years ago to young Joseph has come back to haunt them big time. Now they can see their entire lives coming to a ruinous end. "Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so, but the man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. As for the rest of you, go in peace to your father." Then Judah came. So there's Judah that's, you know, showing all the leadership here. Judah says, "Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh." We know, I want to speak to you and say a few things, but, you know, gulp. I know you're important, so please bear with me. "My Lord asked his servants, you know, some time ago, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my Lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead,'" because that's Joseph, "'and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him," you know, dotes on him, as he, of course, did previously at Joseph. "Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him.' And we said to my Lord, 'The lad cannot leave his father, but if he should leave his father would die.' But you said to your servants, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more.'" You get no more food, because I'm the guy that signs it off. "So it was when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, 'Go back and buy a little food.' But we said, 'We cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down, for we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, "Surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my grey hair with sorrow to their grave. Now therefore,' says Judah, 'when I come to your servant my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. He will just drop dead on the spot once we return without young Benjamin. So your servants will bring down the grey hair of your servant our father with sorrow to their grave.'" So I can't go back, basically, he's saying, because it'll just bring the immediate death of our dad. Simple as that. "For your servant, Judah, became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever.'" And here's Judah now really stepping up to the mark. "Now therefore, please let your servant," that's me, Judah, "let me, Judah, remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers." So Judah saying, "I am prepared. In fact, not prepared, I'm offering. And please take me as a sacrifice. Take me as a slave. Let young boy go. Let Rachel's youngest son go. Take me. I'll step into it. I'll sacrifice myself and my home and my background. Take me." Now, of course, that's a long way for actually any brother to go. But, you know, Judah, a long way for him. He's the guy that says, you know, what profit is there in killing him? Let's sell him. So there's been a lot of movement here in the brothers. Verse 34, "For how shall I go to my father If the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father. And moving on to chapter 45, obviously this is all quite heartfelt stuff. And at this point, Joseph can take no more. Then Joseph, chapter 45, verse 1, could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." That's of the Egyptians, that would be. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud, because he was sort of soft. This is in his heart all along, but he's going through, this dramatic act of being hard and rough and demanding, because I guess he's either testing to see if they really had moved on in that time, and clearly they have. Here's Judah standing before him saying, "I will sacrifice myself and my home, my own family, if you'll take me as a slave and let little Benjamin go." So, Joseph was broken up at that point. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph!" Not quite sure how he says that, but "I'm Joseph, does my father really still live?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. One translation says, terrified. Because, Joseph, what they mean, the one who, And of course, it's been on their minds ever since, particularly the last few months. It's all they've thought about is our sin, our great iniquity, found us out, that's why we're in trouble. And then the worst thing possible, he's there. And he's not only there, he's there as basically the head of Egypt, who can get anything done, who commands armies, who commands executioners, if necessary. And they're absolutely terrified. They're witless. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near me," because you know where they are at this point, all trying to get out the door. And they came near, I'm sure rather slowly. And he said, of course, he'd now be speaking Hebrew, so I guess that's persuasive. "I'm Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here." He's not going to hide that fact. "For God sent me here before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years to come, in which will be neither ploughing nor harvesting." So it's still a long, long way to go. "And God sent me here before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he, God, has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." So that's pretty good. Joseph is in a position of power. He can do things. But notice he says here, it wasn't really me that did it. It was God who brought me here to preserve the people and preserve even you yourselves. Verse 9, "Hasten, go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph,'" that would have been astonishing words to hear, "'God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry.'" Now, at this point, you've got to ask a couple of questions. Some people say that, God is in charge of absolutely every single thing that happens in our lives. Every detail. The expression sometimes, God is sovereign. God's will always happens. Everything that happens, therefore, must be God's will. And everything that happened to Joseph was God's will. That's what people will say when it says here, doesn't it, that God sent Joseph to Egypt to bring preservation to the Egyptians and to the family of Jacob and so on. And I've explained before, quite a number of times, so I'm not going to belabor it too much today, that God does not always get his will. Now, some people think, impossible. God is God. God is sovereign. God always gets what he wants. God always gets his will. No, he does not always get his will. God has given you and me and mankind generally a huge amount of free choice to make our own decisions. And those decisions are not always the way God wants them to go. People often do things that God does not want or will. For example, you can go and rob a bank. Not recommending that, of course, but if you wanted to go and rob a bank, you could. Of course, there's a commandment that God says, thou shalt not steal, but if you want to ignore God's commanded will and go the opposite way, your choice, you can commit adultery. Now, God says, thou shalt not commit adultery, but David committed adultery. That wasn't God's will, and plenty of people since then, including, well, anyway, so that's something that people do that is not God's will. If you think of the example we've often used when the Exodus took place and Israel's heading off to the Promised Land, God said expressly, go across, take the land, live in it, enjoy. And all the people said, no, you brought us out here to kill us. The giants are in the land. It's too strong for us. We're going to go back to Egypt. And God said, no, go across. And you know what happened? You know, God's will did not get carried out. God's will was that they cross the Jordan and live and prosper in the land, and they all of them above the age of 20 died in the wilderness in the next 40 years. That was not God's will. If we look at Deuteronomy 30, verses 19 and 20, Deuteronomy chapter 30, and verses 19 and 20. Deuteronomy 30. This is Moses talking just to the next generation who were about, actually, to go across the Jordan. And he says, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you. I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. That's two different ways. So he says, look, people, on this direction, it goes to life. Over that direction, it'll take you to death or blessing and cursing. There are different ways. Therefore, choose. You choose. I've told you, go that way, it will bring you life and blessing. I've told you, go that way, it will bring you cursing and death. Now, you choose. And in case we're struggling about it, he says, choose life. That both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey his voice, that you may cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. But it's their choice. God says, choose life through Moses. Choose life, that's the way to go. That's my will, that's my desire, that's my preference. What do the people do? Well, you know the history, for the most part, like you and me, we've chosen the other way. That's not God's will, but that's what we choose. God's given us a great deal of free choice. Look at Ezekiel 18 and verse 21 to start with. Ezekiel 18 verse 21. But if a wicked man turns from all his sins which he has committed, that'll be his choice. God's not going to force you or me to choose. He'll show us the choices and he'll instruct us which way to go, but that's a choice that you and I can make. If a wicked man turns from all his sins which he has committed, keeps all my statutes, and does what is lawful and right, he shall surely live. He shall not die because he's made the right choice. Verses 26 to 32. When a righteous man, on the other hand, turns away from his righteousness, commits iniquity and dies in it, it is because of the iniquity which he has done that he dies. Again, when a wicked man turns away from the wickedness which he committed and does what is lawful and right, he preserves himself alive because he's making a better choice. Verse 29, yet the house of Israel says, the way of the Lord is not fair. O house of Israel, is it not my ways which are fair and your ways which are not fair? Therefore I will judge you, O house of Israel, everyone according to his ways, or you could say to his choices, says the Lord God, repent and turn from all your transgressions so that iniquity will not be your ruin. Please turn. Change. Do not go that way. Verse 31. Cast away from you all the transgressions which you have committed and get yourselves a new heart and a new spirit, for why should you die, O house of Israel? For I have no pleasure in the death of one who dies, says the Lord God. Therefore, turn and live. But that's God's desire. That's God's heart. He has zero pleasure in the death of the wicked. Zero pleasure in the death of anybody. But people continue to do the wrong things, make wrong choices. Like Israel at the River Jordan, we are not going to go across. Like, you know, King David and others. But God says, turn, turn. Why will you die? Why do you want to go that way? Please do what I ask you to do. Please choose my way. Please adopt my will. And of course, most of the time, people don't. So in that sense, you know, God's will doesn't just happen because God wants it to. God's given us so much free choice. Going back to the story of Joseph, God did not make Joseph's brothers hate him. And surely that's obvious. Joseph's brothers were jealous, envious because of the way their father, you know, doted on Joseph, given his coat of many colors, whatever. And his brothers hated him. Did God make them hate him? Nope. In fact, love your neighbor as yourself. I know that wasn't actually available exactly then as a scripture, but nonetheless, brothers ought to love each other. God did not make his brothers conspire to kill him. So you're thinking, well, you know, Joseph ended up as a slave in Egypt. Did God do all of that? Well, no, God did not make the brothers hate Joseph. God did not make his brothers conspire to kill him. And if things hadn't changed slightly, they might well have literally tried to kill him. But guess what? At just the right moment, as a strange coincidence, a caravan of merchants comes passing by and Judah thinks, hey, guys, hey, brothers, let's not kill him. Let's hand him over and sell him to this passing caravan. Now, that, I suspect, would be God's hand involved, making sure that there's an alternative, an attractive alternative that comes along at just the right moment, and it whisks Joseph away from his brothers, which might actually be wise in the longer term, because who knows when they might next think of killing him. Off he gets to Egypt. And he could be sold as a slave to anybody, some brutal person or some lowly manual work in a field somewhere. But it just so happens he ends up being employed by Potiphar, head of state security, a cultured individual, probably important, where he's going to observe Joseph's examples of rulership and authority in a good learning environment. And then, of course, surely God did not send Potiphar's wife to attempt to seduce Joseph, did he? That wasn't God. I mean, just hold your place where you are, but look at James 1:13. James chapter 1, verse 13. And James 1:13 says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. So Joseph could never have said, well, you know, God tempted me. It wasn't God who was tempting Joseph. So therefore, you know, God didn't make his brothers hate him. God didn't make his brothers plan to kill him. God didn't send Potiphar's wife to attempt to seduce him or accuse him of rape. But of course, Joseph now ends up somewhat more protected in a political prison where he meets, you know, key court officials, the Pharaoh's, you know, butler, the Pharaoh's baker, and of course, shortly afterwards, Joseph is prime minister. So certainly, you know, things work to a very good outcome, but not every part of that process was a God sovereignly making his brothers hate him and sovereignly sending Potiphar's wife to attempt to seduce him. There's an old saying, you know, that when life throws you lemons, you should make lemonade. And even God does that. Even though there's plots and plans against Joseph, perhaps Satan behind the scenes, he's not mentioned anywhere, you know, God takes the lemons that are thrown at Joseph and he turns them into lemonade. So it reminds us of, we turn there to Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28 is sort of shows how these things can work out, sometimes with surprising outcomes. Obviously, God wanted Joseph in Egypt in high office, but the question how he got there, I think God had to sort of adapt and respond to some of the things that were taking place. But Romans 8:28 tells us, "And we know, if we do know, that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." It doesn't say all things are good. Right? Not all things are good. Having your brother plan to kill you is not good. Being hated by your brothers is not good. Being sold into slavery is not good. But all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called, which clearly Joseph was called to be prime minister of Egypt by God, according to his purpose. So God worked these things out in a very clever way and brought Joseph to exactly where he needed to be, prime minister. And that's pretty clever. But another question you might ask at this point, at least I've asked it, is, okay, so God wants Joseph in Egypt in a very, very high position of control and authority so he can, you know, save the surrounding nations from the coming famine. Okay, I get that. The brother's hatred and selling me to slavery wasn't the ideal way, but God worked with that and worked things out to his ends. But hang on a second, why wouldn't God just send rain on Egypt? Wouldn't that be a lot easier, sort of, you know, just change the weather slightly, send plenty of rain so the Nile will flood, and then you can get Joseph back to his dad, you know, by the time he's 18. Don't need all the intervening years and all that stuff, do you, surely? So why, I mean, maybe in a sense you could say, well, if your brothers hate him, perhaps a year later or another year they'd plan to kill him, so perhaps as a getting away from his brothers might be an idea. But there's probably a bigger reason, a much bigger reason behind this, this is at least my thinking, is that at this stage of the game, the nation of Israel is really only 70-odd people. It's a big family, you know, 70-odd people, but it's not really big enough. And God wants to preserve his chosen people, Israel, as separate from the world around them. They're not to follow other gods. They're not to intermarry. The family of Judah is the family from which Jesus Christ will ultimately descend. And it's actually going to be a very high risk if you leave the family of Israel in the land of Canaan. Because the risk of them, you know, they're like the brothers. They're sort of quite mischievous. And the idea or the risk of them intermarrying and picking up other gods and goddesses, it's a high risk to leave them there. Abraham didn't want, you know, Isaac to marry locally. Abraham didn't want Isaac to marry locally. Isaac didn't want Jacob to get married to a Canaanite girl. Judah, now he married a Canaanite girl, and that caused a number of problems. So it looks like part of the master plan here of God is to take the family of Israel out of Canaan, all 70 of them, down to Egypt, out of the influence of Canaan for quite a long time. And even in Egypt, it turns out, the rules and the protocol are such that the Egyptians won't want to be near them. The Egyptians look down on people like the Israelites. And so they'll go into Egypt. They'll turn out to be in a very pleasant and prosperous part of Egyptian territory. But the Egyptians will actually remain detached from them. So strangely enough, you take down 70 people out of Canaan, where they're in danger of being contaminated and all sorts of problems. You bring them into another country where they are preserved and protected on their own. And when we get to the story in the book of Exodus, suddenly there are about 2 million of them. And they've kept, if you like, their separation from the surrounding nations. So really, that's probably what this plan was about, getting Joseph down there and making reasons and space for the entire family to come down too. Let's turn to Genesis 46. Verses 1 through 7. I'll tell a lie, sorry, 7:45. Yeah. Hadn't quite finished that.
We're not going to finish.
Verse 9. Hasten, go to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children, your children's children, your flocks, your herds, all that you have. There I'll provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt, of all that you have seen, and you shall hasten and bring my father down here. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. So they go back and collect Jacob. Verse 25, then they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still, obviously only momentarily, because he did not believe them. I guess you just would never know with this crowd of brothers. When they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived. Then Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. Actually, he's going to live another 70-odd years. Chapter 46, verse 1. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba. That's just at the outskirts of Canaan. And offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And Isaac had offered sacrifices there. Abraham had offered sacrifices at Beersheba. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. He said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. This seems to be part of the plan to take the people before they are lost to the world into a sort of refuge where they can be secure and just grow among themselves. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes, I guess when you die. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones, their wives, and the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their goods, which they acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons, his sons' sons, his daughters, his sons' daughters, all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. The lot. Nobody left. The whole bunch. Verse 26. All the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph, who were born to him in Egypt, were 2 persons. All the persons of the house of Jacob, who went to Egypt, were 70. So that's how they started. And, of course, in the book of Exodus, there's 2 million plus. Verse 28. Then he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. That was 20-odd years gone, Joseph is now a nearly 40-year-old man, and Israel's well over 100. There's a lot of time here to catch up. And Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I've seen your face, because you're still alive. Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house, who were in the land of Canaan, have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock, and they've brought their flocks, their herds, and all that they have. It shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what's your occupation? You shall say, your servant's occupation had been with livestock from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. So there's going to be reasons why the Egyptians don't want to hang around the family of Israel, which means they're going to be left on their own to grow up among themselves with no risk of intermarrying Egyptians, because that's not going to happen, and of course free from Canaan, where they were really quite vulnerable. Chapter 47. Then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers, their flocks, their herds, and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed they are in the land of Goshen." He took five of his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What's your occupation? What do you do?" And they said, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen." Because Pharaoh obviously owes a lot. The nation owes a lot to Joseph. I mean, everybody owes a lot to Joseph. So the instructions are, Joseph, Goshen is the best land there is. Yep, it's your family's. And if you know any competent men among them, make them chief herdsmen over my livestock. Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Because, you know, Shem lived to be, what, 500 or 600, I think. And Shem outlived Abraham. Abraham was Jacob's grandfather. So Shem was around, I think, in that sort of time, 600-year-old. And Jacob's saying, "I'm 130. Oh, I'm a youngster." Just recently, some of my family were 600. So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread, according to the number in their families. Well, I guess we're sort of running out of time, and there's not really too much more to continue in the story. But I guess, as we just sort of summarize very briefly, a happy ending there for Joseph, for Jacob, for the brothers, for the family. And you can just, I think, look at Joseph's life and think the guy was genuinely outstanding. Even though he had very adverse circumstances to go through, great difficulties, he appears to have been a man of faith and trust and patience. He maintained a positive attitude, must have done, because he was respected and promoted by his peers around him, by Potiphar, by the captain over the prison, a man who came to a very lofty position, and a man who really had no grudges against his brothers, and a man used mightily by God to really secure the future of the nation of Israel. And so a great story, a great man, some great examples there for us, and hopefully some at least of that that you and I can, you know, ponder in our own lives. Have we done as well as Joseph? Quite honestly, I think the answer is no. I think he was very outstanding, and probably the nation of Israel was a great deal too. The man Joseph. Okay, with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.